From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. In a very real sense, several of our fellow conspiracy realists are here today because this is our weekly listener mail segment where we share some of the most fascinating, disturbing at times, stories brought to us by your fellow listeners. Today's adventure will take us down a bottomless rabbit hole. It will take us to some unsolved crime. And we'll also see some, you know, troubling but oddly hilarious supervillain shit that was unknowingly said on camera. So you're in for a wild ride. Folks, I was thinking one of the best ways to set up this very first piece of listener mail, Noel, is to maybe talk a little bit about both your work and my work with some of the crime shows that we've done or produced based in the Pacific Northwest, one of which I believe was called Murder in Oregon, the UEP. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was one of the projects that back when I guess I had more of the luxury to be able to do so, was really hands-on with. Spent a lot of time in Salem, Oregon, which is the capital of Oregon, but it's also like, it's not what you would think of when you think Oregon. We've talked about this before, but Oregon, in my mind, has always been this kind of liberal, shining bastion, you know, in the woods. And of course, we associate that with Portland, the dream of the 90s and all of that. Portlandia, put a bird on it. People from Portland probably hate that image. And it's certainly much more complex a city than that. The rest of Oregon is all over the place. I mean, it can get very rural, and it has a history of corruption in law enforcement. A lot of drug trafficking goes on there. There have been a lot of like organized crime there over the years. A gentleman by the name of Phil Stanford, who I worked with on both the original season of Happy Face, Ben UEP'd the second season of that show, and the show Murder in Oregon. Phil is a crime writer. He's a true crime writer, kind of almost like a hard-boiled detective type dude. He really is like that, you know, epitomizes that image. Like you picture him wearing a trench coat and, you know, carrying around a pad with like a spiral bound pad kind of, and like, you know, has some kind of press credentials tucked into his hat. Not exactly, but he's lived a very interesting life. And he has written several books about Portland and about Oregon and about the history of corruption in the government and all of this stuff in terms of vice, because it was away from the prying eyes of the mainstream, because anyone that's been there knows that Oregon is a very rugged, wildernessy type place. And Salem is a very small town, very sleepy kind of town, even though it's the capital. There's a big, government complex, and the story of Murder in Oregon has to do with the assassination, alleged assassination of a government official who was looking into corruption in the state prison system, which is based there in Oregon. Today's story is another corruption and potential corruption, alleged corruption, and just conspiracy angle from the state of Oregon. And it caught my eye because the subject of the email was Oregon, the murder conspiracy state, ? And this comes from and I'm just going to give a quick summary of her email. Hey guys, this case of a 15-year-old girl murdered in a small Oregon coast town back in 2000 holds every required element of a great suspense film, except one thing: who did it? We thought we had the answer when the boyfriend of the victim was convicted of voluntary manslaughter in 2011 and sentenced to 10 years. It'd be almost a decade later when it was discovered that he didn't do it. He was released and has filed a lawsuit against just about any person that was involved in the investigation, understandably so, claiming he was set up, framed, including my now deceased father-in-law, who had investigated the case originally. I'm going to leave the rest of this out for now, but We texted a bit earlier, and when I mentioned I'd love to pitch this as a full-length episode, she was more than happy to talk. She has a close, direct connection to this case by family, and I think would be a very interesting person to talk to in regards to a full-length version of this. But let's do just go through the kind of broad strokes. She did a good job of setting it up. But the gentleman in question, whose name could not be more, I think ironic is the wrong word. It's just perfect. His name is Nicholas McGuffin. You guys know what a MacGuffin is? It's like, yeah, of course you do. It's a plot device, you know, particularly used in film. That's essentially like a red herring, where it is a thing or a character that is used to distract you from the real thing, or used exclusively to propel the plot forward. That's a MacGuffin. It's sort of like almost a misdirection. So this perfectly fits that, because Nicholas McGuffin, who is now 38, has filed and named multiple Coquille, Coos County, and Oregon State police officials in these multiple lawsuits, alleging that they trumped up evidence against him in order to get their case closed. Essentially, what happened is McGuffin was dating the victim, Leah Freeman, who was 15 at the time, and McGuffin was, I believe, 18, and this all happened in June of 2000. Freeman essentially vanished after leaving a friend's house, and one of her shoes was found by a cemetery, and McGuffin was taken in for questioning. Unbeknownst to him, the intent of bringing him in was to photograph him and look for defensive wounds, which of course are, you know, cuts or things, you know, that might have some DNA from the victim or anything that looks like he was in an altercation, you know, during this alleged homicide. But he gets let go. And the case remains cold for almost 10 years. No, more than 10 years. This is in 2000. In 2008, a new sheriff comes into town, essentially. A new whatever. Yeah, I think sheriff is the right word. And he has a lot of pressure on him to solve this almost decade-old case. He identifies suspects from the prior investigation, also realizes that like tons of evidence was poorly handled and misplaced. Even like there was some evidence that was shipped off to Scotland Yard in the UK for analysis that they never got back. And they found like all of these undeveloped rolls of film. So it looks like there's some negligence, dare we say even incompetence, there going on in the first place even. We'll get into this, you know, another time, but essentially they were able to get enough evidence together based on a shoe that was found in the cemetery. By the way, they found the shoe in the cemetery in the initial investigation. Not too far from there, they found Leah Freeman's body on like an embankment in the woods. And they got a conviction. The case went to a grand jury and McGuffin was indicted, and he was found guilty of manslaughter, which is interesting. It was a 10-2 verdict and was sentenced to 10 years in prison, which he spent part of at the Snake River Correctional Institution and then got sent to a labor camp. That's a whole nother issue there, in Oregon's Tillamook State Forest. I guess the labor camp was preferable because according to an ABC News article about the case written by Lauren Efron, Karen Schiffman, Joseph Ree, and Ali Young, it's quite a in-depth piece about the whole history of the case. That was because of good behavior that he got sent to the labor camp. So I guess that was, you know, better than being in the Snake River Penitentiary. But recently, just a couple years ago, Malheur County Circuit Senior Judge named Patricia Sullivan overturned McGuffin's case, or conviction rather, because apparently some of that evidence was processed in the Oregon State Police Crime Lab. And they knew this at the time, but did not disclose that they found not only his DNA on the girl's shoe, but another unidentified person's DNA on the shoe. So the judge understandably ruled that this should have been disclosed, and that if the jury had known that information, then they would have probably acted differently. So I think this is a very interesting case. There's a lot more to it that we haven't gone into here, and I'd love to put it forth for a full episode sometime soon and speak to about it as well, because she has direct ties to the case. It's ongoing, and there is a good bit of interesting detail that we have that shows that there could well be a conspiracy afoot and serious corruption going on, whether it's only to cover up negligence or whether there's something more nefarious going on there. I think it's one to look into further.
For sure.
So more on that soon. And thank you for that email and for hipping us to this case. It's definitely, there's a lot of intrigue going on here and look forward to digging into it more. But for now, let's take a quick break and we'll be back with more listener mail.
And we have returned. First, this is a listener mail from one of our fellow conspiracy realists, but this is also part of a larger conversation. I want to personally thank everybody who's reached out to the show or reached out to me one way or another to ask a question that I have asked the crew off air before, which is, why haven't we done an episode about lobbying? If you're not in the U.S., you probably recognize lobbying by its other name, which is bribery. And it is legalized bribery here, or it functions in that way. Now, that's not to say that all lobbyists are bad. There are many, many groups and individuals who are lobbying the halls of political power for the kinds of things that we all think are generally good, like an increase in literacy, more affordable health care in a country where, you know, you can die because you are broke. Not because your condition is terminal, but because you are broke. So there are people lobbying. Yeah.
No more death tax, Ben.
Right, sure. So they're no, what we're saying is you can't throw the entirety of the big money baby out with the bathwater, but the rules of comedy do encourage us to punch up. And so that's why I was so over the moon to receive an email recently from Biker Girl. Biker Girl did give us their real name, but we're going to use your nickname because it's a cool nickname. We're a very pro nickname crowd here. That is what we would lobby for, or one of the many things. Here's what he said. Biker Girl sent a link of a story that had already been interesting to me, and I think several of my cohort as well. And Biker Girl, all he said was, "Now that's a conspiracy. I'm sure you guys heard about it. It would be cool if you guys covered it in a podcast." Well, good news, Biker Girl. You have become the proverbial straw on the podcast camel's back. We're going to finally do a full episode on the problems with lobbying, at least in the U.S. And one great example of this and the power that can be wielded behind the scenes here comes directly from your email. So one of the many reports about a hapless lobbyist named Keith McCoy. Keith McCoy is having a bad month. Being a lobbyist can be fraught with complications and sometimes dangers. You know, there's a great fictionalized series about lobbying called K Street, I believe, and it was actually pulled after its second season, not because of ratings. People like the show. It was pulled at the direction of members of Congress, because it was getting a little too close to how the sausage is made, how the pork gets barreled. So Keith McCoy fell for a prank. It is the age of the internet. Pranks are everywhere, you know. Don't beat yourself up too bad if you fall for one. But Keith believes that he is at a job interview, right? And Keith is being asked questions about his work with a company we all probably recognize called ExxonMobil. And he doesn't just spill the beans. He like takes a figurative can of beans and one by one rubs them on his face and then plays with them and, you know,
like,
puts them in his mouth and throws them back up a little bit. And the people who are interviewing him, by the way, they love this because they have no intention of hiring him. He has been duped by Greenpeace,
which we mentioned some Greenpeace activities in a previous episode on France's terrorist attack in New Zealand, right? The Rainbow Warrior attack. So Greenpeace, they're known for their unorthodox protests, their unorthodox approaches to things. So activists from Greenpeace posed as headhunters, and they were going to do Zoom interviews with McCoy, as well as a former Exxon lobbyist, Dan Easley. And McCoy gave an insider view that was quite embarrassing to ExxonMobil and should be, I think, in no small way distressing to the average resident of the U.S. or, you know, the resident of the globe. He said, look, ExxonMobil will publicly support a carbon tax because we're also working to make sure it never gets enough support to actually happen. It was like he was like Mac in Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where he says, I'm playing both sides so that I always come out on top. And then, you know, naturally someone's like, well, are you really? Because you probably shouldn't say that to me. So he says that carbon tax is a non-starter, and you can see him saying things. You can see the footage of this, clips from this interview. As a matter of fact, let's play one here.
You want to be able to go to the chief. Yeah. And so the chief knows you, that you can go to the chief and say, look, we've got this issue. We need Congressman so-and-so to be able to introduce this bill. We need him to make a floor statement. We need him to send a letter. Yeah. You name it. We've asked for everything.
So this guy has all his cards, all his beans on the table. And he's saying, look, Exxon funds, he verbatim says this, Exxon funds shadow groups to spread misinformation about climate science. Here's a particular quote from him. Did we join some of these shadow groups to work against some of the early efforts? Yes, that's true. And he says something else important, even more disturbing. But there's nothing illegal about that. We're looking out for our investments. We're looking out for our shareholders. And then he talks about how they single out moderate Democrats to push them toward the Exxon's primary goal, which is to, you know, avoid increasing costs, avoid legislation that they think goes too far to combat climate change. So far, I want to check in, so this is not just me monologuing, guys. So far, did you guys hear about this story earlier? This is a few days ago.
I did. This is definitely an Apple News, like, shot across the bow. And I was like, I think it was Yahoo News that I initially, like, that it sent me to, I guess. And it didn't look like much of an article. It just, again, maybe I just don't use Yahoo News enough. And I couldn't ascertain whether it was real or not. And I didn't take the time to look into it. Though I am back on that article now, today, Ben, and I notice it pushing out to a Guardian article that is giving me a soft paywall. I've never seen a paywall with the Guardian, by the way. Oh, wait. I just had to click on something that said, I'll do it later. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I gave an email address earlier for the Oregonian, too. But, I mean, honestly, is it that big of a surprise? I mean, you know, that it got caught is the story, but I just, you know, and of course, it's alarming when you hear this stuff, like, spelled out in front of you and so starkly lit like this, but I just can't imagine the kind of conversations like-minded lobbyists in this type of industry have over cocktails. Like, it's got to be
gut-wrenching. Sure, but we're in a bubble. Informationally, yeah. Like the things that we understand, a lot of our fellow listeners understand as gross and normal and commonplace would probably astonish and disgust a lot of other people. This is terrifically embarrassing for several members of Congress because McCoy specifically shouts them out. He says, I talk with Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, weekly. I talk to his office all the time. He says, look, if we need Senator so-and-so to show up on the floor to sign something, we need them to write a letter, we can just ask for it. We'll get him to do that.
We'll just donate some more to his campaign.
Donate some more to the campaign. And so he says that, of course, this is legal. He doesn't say whether it should be legal. He also has a... He's also made a splash in the ongoing debate. Of course, ExxonMobil immediately walks away from this as fast as they can without looking like they're running. The CEO, Woods, said that the lobbyist comments in no way reflect ExxonMobil's position.
Mm.
which is demonstrably untrue. That's the interesting, what's interesting about that statement is that it is false.
Well, it's a cover, right? The lobbying firms that are employed by the company are then a cover. So this exact thing, if this thing happens, it's like paying for insurance. Well, that was our lobbying firm. Of course, you know, they fight tooth and nail for our interests, but you know, we at ExxonMobil would never say those things or believe those things.
Yeah. Greenpeace posted the video online and you can see him. You could say that he's just playing real politic in a way, because he says, look, no one's going to propose a tax on all Americans. And the cynical side of me says, yeah, we kind of know that, but it gives us a talking point. We can say, well, what is ExxonMobil for? Well, we're for a carbon tax because we know it will never happen, because we work to make sure it will never happen.
Jeez.
Yeah, I just watched this film that just came out on HBO Max called No Sudden Move with Don Cheadle and Benicio del Toro.
Soderbergh, right?
It is. And I really liked it. It uses wide angle lenses very oddly, where every shot, the camera moves and there's distortion on the edges. Like if you have a wide angle that you don't crop in, it's sort of an old school technique. You get this weird kind of like almost warping on the edges and vignetting effects. So it's a little distracting, but people either seem to love it or hate it, but I was a little distracted by it, but overall thought it was a great movie. And maybe this is a mild spoiler. I think it's pretty clear from any of the marketing materials, but it takes place in Detroit, and it's about essentially this relationship between the big four, or the big five rather, auto manufacturers in Detroit, and the idea of the catalytic converter being a thing that for the longest time was kept out of cars because of lobbyists and because of collusion with these different companies, essentially saying they could never get it down to a form factor that would allow it to fit in a car. And it was because they didn't want to spend the R&D on doing that. They didn't want to pollute less. And that's the kind of things that lobbyists can really negatively impact. I mean, it's kind of egregious.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the specific example with McCoy, Greenpeace has further said they're going to reveal claims that Exxon fought in secret to prevent a ban on several toxic chemicals, and that Exxon is using a rinse and repeat strategy for its playbook on climate change to head off regulations and plastic. Remember, folks, it wasn't too long ago that the the corporate powers that be were telling you that the world was going to hell in a handbasket because you had the audacity to use a plastic straw. Right. Never mind that in excess of 89% of the world's of the ocean's plastic waste comes from commercial fishing. Like, it's all about putting the burden on the consumer, right? So that the company doesn't have to pay or compensate for the amount of damage it's doing. And, you know, this becomes very sensitive to a lot of people. But the issue is not really at this point, it's not really a matter of where you stand in the debate over government regulation or private business or, you know, oversight or liberty or whatever other words are being thrown around at a politician's convenience. This is about misleading people. This is about transparency. And this is a matter that will only become more important. If anything, I feel like we're way overdue for an episode on lobbying. It's probably going to have to be a two-parter, heads up. It's a murky business. I've had connections with lobbyists, and again, I'm not painting with a broad brush. It very quickly, when we see this amount of money, this amount of power, and this lack of transparency, very quickly becomes perfect, fertile soil for all sorts of genuine conspiracies that do affect you. They affect all of us. So we're going to pause for a word from our sponsors. We'll be back in a few weeks with a deep dive into lobbying. But in the meantime,
head over to YouTube.
Yes, in the meantime, head over to YouTube and check out that interview. Spoiler alert: he didn't get the job because Greenpeace, you know, wasn't actually planning to hire him.
And watch our original video: should lobbying be banned?
And while you're doing that, we'll take our brief break and we'll return with one more piece of correspondence from you.
And we're back. Ben, that reminds me of that show Drilled. We spoke with one of the creators and the hosts of that show Drilled. It reminds me so much of that.
Podcast, right?
All right, so we are moving on to a message from, we're going to call this person KT. I think that'll work out. KT says, I apologize in advance as this may turn into a Charlie Day conspiracy board with strings all over. I don't know if I believe it all, but there are a bunch of weird things that have happened that may be connected. I'll try to be brief. There's a ton of rabbit holes to go down here, depending on how much you want to ruin your day researching cold trafficking and abuse.
All about it.
Yep. In the mid-2000s, the Center County, Philadelphia, District Attorney Ray Gricar, that's spelled R-A-Y-G-R-I-C-A-R, disappeared under mysterious circumstances. Eventually, his computer was found with the hard drive missing. He had been involved in declining to pursue investigating Jerry Sandusky, that's the Penn State University's monster? Anyway, that's in Center County where he was the district attorney. Here's where it gets crazy. John DeCamp named Sandusky as involved in child trafficking and pedophilia in the late 80s, early 90s, during his investigation into the Franklin cover-up, which we have spoken about on the show before, the Franklin cover-up. Another Franklin cover-up investigator, Gary Caradori, died under mysterious circumstances in a plane crash after allegedly finding something important. Maybe Ray Gricar was changing his mind about Sandusky and was killed. They have been, as far as I know, baseless claims that Sandusky and Epstein and even Saville were all connected. There's also another mysterious death from 2003 in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, of a U.S. Assistant Attorney General, Jonathan Luna, that some conspiracies link with Ray Gricar. I don't know if it means anything, but it's super weird. Thanks for reading. Take care, KT. So there's a lot of detail, a lot of proper nouns in that message from KT. Thank you, KT, for writing to us. But we're just going to dip our toes into this one for today's episode. You can go over to northcentralpa.com and read this article titled No Answers 16 Years Later in Disappearance of Center County DA, PSP Says Case Still Open. This article was posted February 24th, 2021, and again, it's talking about 16 years after this initial disappearance. I'm going to give you some of the bullet points here from what happened to Ray Gricar, at least what we know. On April 15th, 2005, Ray Gricar told his girlfriend that he was going to head out for the day. He wasn't going to go to work. He was going to go for a drive, and it appears that he did just that. He went from his home to a place called Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, and he disappeared. His car was found there, a Mini Cooper that happened to be red in color. And inside this vehicle, by the way, they found it 2 days later on the 17th, but they found his cellular phone, which was turned off. And that's a 2005 cellular phone. I have no idea what model of cell phone a district attorney would have that year, but it was probably pretty nice. They looked for him for quite a while to try and find evidence of, you know, perhaps he took his own life. Perhaps, you know, something, some foul play was involved, but it was very strange. He was a missing person for a while. They turned up his computer, as KT said in that email. The hard drive was removed. It was in the Susquehanna River. And, you know, it had been degraded quite a bit just from being in a river and, you know, not having a hard drive. So there was no real evidence picked up on that. There's a bunch of weird things that could be factors in here that are difficult to sift through because Gricar was a district attorney, which meant he was the point person in putting away a lot of people. Anytime the state or the, you know, that his district was going toe to toe with someone for a prosecution, he was the guy. So he probably made a lot of enemies. And according to those nearest to him, they would say that he was very cautious when deciding whether or not to go forward with a case because he didn't, you know, you don't want to go against a powerful person unless you've got an open and shut case, I think is how you'd say it. Unless you're sure you can prosecute effectively.
And it's airtight.
But the weird connections here to Sandusky and some of the other stuff exist, it would be up to us, you know, in doing some intense research here to decide if there's sand to any of that stuff. The reason why I say that is because in this article, as well as a few other articles that have come out since his disappearance, including one in, it's from NBC Channel 10 Philadelphia, posted in 2011, titled DA Who Never Charged Sandusky Has Been Missing Since 2005. According to that article, the original one we are talking about, and several individual people that were close to him, they think something else was going on. This wasn't a matter of him, you know, choosing to disappear, choosing to, you know, go into witness protection or to, you know, take his own life. There's one person in particular we need to mention, a man named Bob Buhner. He's a former Montour County district attorney who knew Ray really well. And I've got a quote, two separate quotes here for you. He says, "I spoke with Ray right before he went missing. There was no way he was remotely suicidal at that time in 2005. He was getting ready to retire in a few months, 8 months to be exact. He was planning trips across the country. He was going to see his daughter in Seattle, Washington, and was going to visit national parks. He was going to enjoy himself after 35 years of being a prosecutor." Again, this part right here is Buhner's opinion, but he does say that his relationship with Patty, it was his girlfriend's name, Patty Fornicola, I think is how you say it. It was very stable. He was financially sound at that time in 2005. So there aren't a lot of these telltale signs that maybe something was wrong, that just people around him didn't know. But again, if something was really wrong, many people wouldn't know. It's a tough thing. So at least according to Bob, everything seemed to be going well, and he doesn't at least believe that he would have done that. He does say, "I strongly believe that there are several people who are still alive who know what happened to Ray, know how he was lured to Lewisburg, and know what happened when he was there." Because he says that many individuals reached out to him early on in the 2005 to 2010 era, who said these people reached out to Bob with this information. He passed it on to investigators. And this is another quote from Bob. "I had a pretty strong sense of, in general, who was responsible. The actual details, no, but specifically who did it, yes."
And it's weird because he just dancing on the precipice of this rabbit hole, you get the distinct feeling from this guy that law enforcement was putting the slow sauce on some of this, considering, you know, the fact that, you know, he wasn't interviewed until 2015 and the fact that he had people reaching out to him. I believe there was at least one source alleging that Grikar had, quote, run afoul of a person who was in the witness protection program.
That is, I've seen that alleged, but
That's from Buhner. That's a quote.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. He's alleging quite a few things here, but not giving the details because he says he doesn't have the details. It's like he knows the general information, or he believes he knows the general information. Mm-hmm. And again, he passed on those leads, I suppose, to investigators.
Well, he also wants to be careful as a professional. He wants to make sure that he is not saying anything that he cannot back up, right? He wants that airtight case. And you have to be really careful because a misstep could lead to someone escaping justice.
Yeah, exactly. If he says the wrong thing in an interview and somebody's name leaks out there, then you're essentially changing public opinion or possibly changing public opinion through the media before a trial begins, which can lead to a mistrial. I want to read you this last thing here because we're not even getting into the Sandusky stuff yet. I told you about that article from NBC that you can check out, and we're going to keep going down that rabbit hole. But as far as that initial investigation into Ray Grikar's disappearance, the current district attorney of Centre County, a man named Bernie Cantorna, says, quote, "It is an open case. The state police have a lead detective assigned to it. Every year we get leads and we follow them up." Basically saying, yes, this is still ongoing. sorry, I can't talk to you, essentially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There is one weird thing. Oh, man, I found it on the Charlie Project, so I wasn't even going to bring it up, but I'll just mention it here. According to that site, Ray's brother Roy Grecar disappeared under similar circumstances. This time it was in Dayton, Ohio in 1996. Quote, he told his wife he was going out to buy mulch and never returned. Later, his body was pulled from the Great Miami River and his drowning was ruled a suicide. So I don't know. That's a bit weird, right? Two brothers mm-hmm. going in a similar way. Ray's stuff was found in the river. That's very strange. Very, very strange stuff.
Yeah, it's not hard proof that they're connected, but I would agree with your assessment that it is highly irregular, at the very least.
Yep, that's it. Not making any assessments here other than, that's weird. there's a lot more to go on here. I don't have a lot of answers, KT, but thank you for putting us on the case. I'm going to look into this further. We all will, hopefully, and maybe there's a whole episode in here.
Yes. Yeah, well said. And, you know, thank you not just to Anonymous, not just to Biker Girl, not just to KT, but to everyone who has tuned in, who has written to us at our email address, who has contacted us on social or found us via our phone number. We'll give you all that stuff in just a second. Also, thank you to everybody who's, you know, called my name at a crossroads at midnight, whisper into a mirror in the dark. I mean, we try to be easy to find, but before you resort to occult means, if you want to take a page from your fellow listeners' book, why not find us online? We'd love to hear from you.
You can do that in the usual internet places of note. We are Conspiracy Stuff on Facebook, Twitter, and also YouTube, where you can find daily snippets of our audio podcast episodes. You can also find us on Instagram, where we're Conspiracy Stuff Show, not to mention on the telephone.
That's right. We have a phone number, 1-833-STDWYTK. When you give us a call, please tell us what you'd like to refer to you as. It doesn't matter. It could be any cool name or your real name. Let us know if we can use your voice and message on the air. And you have 3 minutes. Leave that message. If you've got more you want to say after that beep happens, I guess, or when the message system cuts you off, please, instead of calling back and leaving more message, send us a good old-fashioned email. Mention that you left us a message, and we will put the two together. So, yes, please use our email. It is
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.